This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. It's been a difficult week for Hillary Clinton. Not only was she diagnosed with a bout of pneumonia, but she's also found herself under fire for labelling half of Donald Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables. These so-called deplorables are the subject of Christopher Caldwell's cover piece, in which he argues that Trump's pandering to the large group that is loyal to him is a more efficient strategy than making a play for minority votes. So, was Clinton's choice of phrasing a conscious attempt to stifle insecure middle America? And how can Trump convince America's forgotten majority to turn out for him? I'm joined now by Christopher Caldwell from Washington and The Spectator's deputy editor, Freddie Gray. So, Christopher, why are white people being drawn to Donald Trump?
Well, you can't necessarily say that they're being driven to Trump because the Republican Party has always been, at least since the Civil Rights era, very reliant on the votes of white people. I mean, the Democrats are very quick to say that it is an overwhelmingly white party. And, you know, in the last election, the Republican Party at the presidential level, the Republicans got almost 60% of white people's votes. So it's not as much of an evolution as it might seem, you know?
And Freddie, what are the main grievances of white America at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think that in that fascinating point that Chris makes, the life expectancy for white Americans is going down. And for that to happen in the world's most developed country is staggering. There's a real serious problem with white America, and white Americans are angry, and there's been a lot written about this. But the way in which Trump appeals to white people is fascinating because he seems to appeal very successfully to a small group, maybe 30-40% of Americans. But can he appeal to enough white Americans to win the White House? I'm not sure he can. And I think, as Chris says in the piece, actually, he's polling worse than Romney did with white people. And he cannot win the election, I don't think, unless he does better than Romney with white people. Is that right, Chris?
I think that's right. And you know, one of the rare journalists who's been able to empathize with the pro-Trump sentiment has been Conrad Black, the old newspaper magnate and now columnist. And according to Black, Trump's strategy has been actually very similar to that of most presidential candidates. You consolidate the wings of your party during the primaries, and then you move to the center. And according to Black, Trump has been very successful at that. The 40% of Americans whom you might call the Archie Bunker vote, who will, you know, will always vote for, you know, a strong military, less immigration, etc. He seems to have them sewed up. And right now he is fighting with Hillary Clinton over 1/6 of the remainder. And that's what this election is about. I think that's a pretty reasonable way of looking at it. You know, Conrad Black's way of looking at it.
And Fred, why has race become such a big issue in this presidential contest?
I think race is always the big issue in America, and it's bound up with sort of concepts of class and all sorts of terribly difficult and unfathomable American issues. The reason it becomes so potent in this election is because it's more complicated than just racism. It's to do with poverty, and it's to do with a white class that, as Chris says, now feel like an oppressed minority, even if they aren't. So when it is dismissed, when Trump supporters are dismissed by Hillary Clinton as a basket of deplorables, that can have a very positive effect for Trump support and also a positive effect for Hillary's support. So it becomes a very sort of divisive race in which people are rowing about racism, but actually there are much bigger things in play here.
And Christopher, do you think that Trump's going to be able to exploit the term deplorables? Is he going to be able to use that to his advantage?
You know, that was a very interesting episode where Hillary Clinton said at a fundraiser for LGBT issues in Manhattan that half of Trump's supporters were deplorables. What's interesting about it is that Hillary Clinton violated rule number one of political campaigning, which is while you can attack your opponent, you must never attack your opponent's voters. And this may have been a conscious thing to do because this was an open to the press event. And so I'm assuming that her reasoning is that she wants to bring social pressure to bear on Trump's voters. But Trump, in reacting to this episode, violated rule number two of political campaigning. And that is, he repeated Hillary's attacks. He's now bought ads re-airing Hillary's attack on his voters in various swing states. I don't know who's going to win this. Probably Trump.
And Freddie, a few weeks ago, it looked as if Hillary Clinton was going to spank Trump in this race. But do you think that's not looking as likely?
Well, certainly the polling has changed. I see today there's another poll showing he's quite far ahead in Ohio. And I think the Clinton's illness episode, I'd like to hear Chris's views on that, which he touches on in the piece, but I'd like to hear a bit more about that. I mean, how her illness will play out, whether she'll even stand now has to be considered. I think certainly she's a much weaker candidate than she looked after the conventions in June.
Chris, do you think Hillary could drop out of the race?
July.
I think it's highly unlikely. I think that, if you'll pardon the expression, she would have to be dragged out of the race. There are two considerations. One is people in the United States, even though we have a presidential system, you know, they are voting for a party. It's sort of like a parliamentary election. You know, however sick Hillary is, the people who support her, they like her ideas on, you know, immigration, guns, taxation, et cetera. And they'll vote for her. They'll vote for the package, even if she is not the face on the, you know, on the outside. But I think another consideration is her strength after the conventions was never as great as it appeared. I mean, she received a big bump from the convention, and a lot of what's happening now is just a return to what's actually going to be a close fought campaign.
And Freddie, how do you think Trump's going to exploit Clinton's convalescence?
Well, I think so far he's been fairly sensible in not sort of actively bragging about her ill health since the collapse, at any rate. But certainly Trump world and the sort of the madness on social media is having a lot of fun at Clinton's expense, but sort of portraying her as a walking corpse. And whether this will in fact generate sympathy for Clinton among the mainstream, or whether Americans really do worry that they can't have somebody in charge who is not physically and perhaps mentally fit, remains to be seen.
And Christopher, the conspiracy theorists seem to be right about Clinton's health. Are they onto something, that shady things seem to be going on behind the scenes?
Well, you know, we don't know, because the Clintons are very secretive. But I think that Clinton is harmed, you know, certainly by the secretiveness of the way she's responded to this. There's something going on there that looks like something more than mere pneumonia. And there is a whole trail of internet video out there that I think Americans are watching pretty carefully.
Chris, sorry, could I just ask, do you think there are there Democrats in Washington that would, I mean, you say it's very unlikely that she'll pull out now, but there must be Democrats, and I'd say even senior Democrats in Washington, that must think, in a way, the best thing that could happen now, and perhaps the only way to stop the Trump train, would be for Clinton to withdraw and somebody else to come in her place?
No, I don't think that Democrats in Washington think that there's anything like the only way to stop the Trump train. I think that Democrats, for the most part, politicians, consultants, I mean, they want to do their work. They want to take nothing for granted. But in their heart of hearts, they cannot believe that Trump has a chance in this race. I think they think this race is sewn up. And I think they think they could wheel Hillary onto the debate stage and still win with her. That said, I mean, I think that there are some people who might prefer Tim Kaine as a candidate. There are a lot of Bernie supporters are saying, oh, now we can have Bernie, which of course is not the case. That's not the way these things work. If, in the event, if there were a sentiment behind replacing Hillary Clinton, it would go back to the Democratic National Committee and you would get someone out of the Clinton orbit.
And obviously we've got the debates coming up. What's Hillary going to do in those? Is she going to appear?
Well, if she can appear, yes, I'm pretty sure she will. And I suppose it will be spun as, you know, she convalesces and she comes back and she really smacks Trump down. That will be how a lot of people will try and spin it. And there's a lot of speculation about who will win in these debates, because you have Hillary Clinton, who's the sort of high school champion debater, who's a lawyer, obviously has some sort of training in argument. And then you've got Trump, who is this sort of WWF version of live political debate. And he has this brilliant ability to insult people. So it'll be fascinating to watch. I suspect Hillary will perform quite well in the debates just by being that bit more boring and seemingly presidential, whereas Trump will do his usual showbiz, slightly vulgar act. What do you think, Chris?
I think one of the strengths of Trump is that there isn't a usual Trump. I mean, he does come out and, you know, as a performer, he likes to surprise people and throw them off balance. And I think that we should now realize that however ungracious some of his arguments and reasonings may sound, he has tended to win the debates he's been involved with. That is, at the end of them, he's tended to have higher support than he had when he went in. I don't think that's true of Hillary Clinton. Until this week, it has been very hard for me to see any upside for Hillary in debating Trump at all. And yes. To that extent, I think this harms her, because I think now she has to debate him.
You suggested that she was possibly setting herself up for a no platforming of Trump. Do you really think that was on the cards?
Yes. I don't know that it was on the cards, but I think it was a possibility.
That was Christopher Caldwell and Freddie Gray. And now, a word from our sponsors.
If you've ever wanted to start a wine cellar, 2016 is the perfect year to begin. Berry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit every taste and budget. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Situated at the end of the Arabian Peninsula, the nation of Yemen hasn't featured much in international headlines of late. And yet, as Peter Oborn writes in this week's notebook, most nights Saudi bombers fly over the Yemeni capital of Sana'a, dealing out random destruction. Yemen has been in a state of civil war since March of 2015, and the rebel Houthi group have successfully encapsulated Sana'a. The government forces, however, closely supported by neighbouring Saudi Arabia, are striking back in the toughest terms. But has Saudi Arabia overstepped the mark and perpetrated war crimes? And what is Britain's involvement in all of this? I am now joined by Peter Oborn and the Daily Telegraph's defence editor, Con Coughlin. So, Peter, you've just been in Yemen. What's going on out there?
Well, it's very unpleasant if you're Yemeni. There is a very brutal and little understood war going on between the Saudi-led coalition, which is Saudi Arabia, and a group of allies strongly supported by Britain and the United States, and the Houthi rebels, so-called, in alliance with Saleh, the former president of the Yemen, who controls the army and most of the geographical territory. And it is, the airport's closed, there's a humanitarian crisis, there's constant bombing raids over much of the Yemen, and there's various other minor wars or confused wars going on as well.
And Con, if, as Peter says, there's a humanitarian crisis, how defensible is Britain's union with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, as Peter knows, I've always supported our strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is very important, not least to stop bombs going off on the streets of London. And the Saudis have been very, very helpful. And we do have a long-standing military alignment with the Saudis. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy, and Peter's written about this, about what the Saudis are doing with the munitions we give them. Now, I've had a look at this as well. I haven't been to Yemen like Peter, so he has the advantage over me, and I applaud his intrepid spirit. But I have been talking to people in the British military. I've been talking to Saudis and others. And clearly, the Saudis have made mistakes in Yemen. There's little doubt about that. And the Saudis admit that. But you also have to remember, and something Peter hasn't really referred to, is that one of the important dynamics of this conflict is that the Houthi rebels are being supported by the Iranians. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guards have been up to the usual tricks of getting people into hospitals so that the civilian casualty rate goes up a lot. And I think some of the human rights groups, particularly Médecins Sans Frontières, are pursuing an anti-Saudi agenda, which I don't think is very helpful to anyone.
Peter?
I'd like to see some evidence that the Iranian Republican Guard is somehow massaging what's going on in the hospitals. I hadn't heard that suggestion. My feeling is that, yes, the Iranians have got a strong influence with the Houthis, and the terrible, the obscene Houthi slogan, curse the Jews and so on, is clearly inspired by the Iranians. But I don't get a sense there's a major Iranian military presence or even military equipment. I mean, otherwise the Saudi planes which fly low over the capital city, Sana'a, would doubtless have been shot down by now. And there's some anger, which you can see among the Houthis, that the Iranians haven't been giving support. As for the mistakes, yes, mistakes. I mean, but there's a repeated bombings of factories, of civilian areas, of hospitals, of schools, of markets. Too many mistakes have been made. As far as MSF running an anti Saudi agenda, four of their hospitals have been hit by Saudi, but four. Médecins Sans Frontières is a very respected, brave international organisation. And they're entitled to feel a bit annoyed with the Saudis, to put it mildly, if their hospitals keep on getting hit, even though they give the Saudis their GPS coordinates, as they always do.
So they say. I mean, as I said, and you'll be aware of this, Peter, that the Saudi coalition, and this is not just the Saudis, it's all the people working with the Saudi coalition, and that includes British military advisers and the Americans, have had a look at these allegations. And the evidence that they've come up with is that some of these claims, not the four specific hospitals you're talking about, but the wider claims that the Saudi-led coalition is deliberately targeting civilian areas, have been exaggerated. We have to tread carefully with this. I mean, I haven't been there. So, you know, I'm reluctant to start talking about hard and fast facts. All I'm saying is as a working journalist like you, Peter, I've spoken to some fairly senior people in the British military, as well as other members of the coalition. And there is a very strong feeling within the Saudi-led coalition that a lot of these allegations have been deliberately massaged, have been exaggerated, and of course the Iranians are not going to declare their hand. They don't. And you know, you like me have followed the Syria conflict very closely, and it's very difficult to find clear-cut evidence of Iranian involvement. And yet, only last week, your newspaper published quite alarming figures that there are 60,000 Iranian operatives supporting the Assad regime. So they're very good at keeping under wraps. And of course, they're not going to deploy anti-aircraft missiles, as that would give the game away. But what they are very good at is manipulating the picture on the ground. And I've followed this for over 30 years. And a lot of what is going on the ground in Yemen is very clever, in my view, Iranian manipulation of the facts to make the Saudi-led coalition look bad. And of course, it plays directly back here to London, where the Commons is pushing very hard on the government to stop supplying the Saudis with munitions. And in the wider context of the big standoff between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that would be an enormous achievement for the Iranians if they were to persuade the British government and the Americans to stop this long-standing and important strategic relationship with Riyadh.
And Peter, now that we've got a new Prime Minister, can we expect a different policy towards the Saudis?
It's a very interesting question, because David Cameron and his Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond were absolutely dedicated not just to the Saudi alliance, but specifically to the Saudi-led coalition's war in the Yemen. Now, are things changing? Boris Johnson, the former editor of The Spectator, is now the Foreign Secretary. He's done two things since becoming Foreign Secretary which interest me. One is that he has corrected the false Foreign Office line repeatedly put out by Philip Hammond and his ministers, that British government had carried out an assessment of alleged Saudi war crimes or breaches of humanitarian law and concluded that there weren't any. The Foreign Office has now withdrawn that claim that they carried out an assessment. And the second thing which Boris Johnson has done is to give full diplomatic recognition to Iran. Now, that's with a British ambassador there. Now, both those moves will have absolutely infuriated the Saudis. The next thing which he's going to come under, which I believe he should do, is to support a full independent international investigation into alleged war crimes committed by all sides in this conflict. And there's an opportunity to go along with that proposal at the United Nations Human Rights Committee, which is meeting at the moment in Geneva.
Con, do you think he's right to restore diplomatic relations with Iran?
Well, of course, one of the reasons we've had to upgrade our relations with Iran is because the Iranians are arresting and jailing British citizens on trumped-up spying charges. In fact, I've forgotten her name now, but there's a human rights worker, a British citizen who's been jailed for 5 years, the usual thing, put before a revolutionary court. And of course, unless you have full ambassadorial status, it is very difficult to lobby to get our citizens released from Tehran. And of course, the reality, we're looking in the aftermath of last year's nuclear deal, which was supposed to see an improvement in Iran's behaviour and perhaps, hopefully, a better cooperation with the Iranians. And all we've seen them do is increase their aggressive posture throughout the Middle East, not just in Yemen, but in Iraq and in Syria. And Peter will know this as well as I do, that the Iranians are running around the Middle East now boasting to the Sunni Arabs that the Iranians have captured three Arab capitals, Beirut, Damascus and Baghdad. And of course, the Saudis and the Saudi-led coalition are now saying, well, we're going to reclaim them all. This is a very difficult area, and I do not envy our new envoy in Tehran, his mission. You will recall that the previous British ambassador to Iran was actually driven out and his dog was kidnapped by the Revolutionary Guard. So it's not exactly the most tranquil of postings.
And Peter, just finally, so who's a better ally in the fight against ISIS, the Saudis or Iran?
I think that Iran has always been the enemy of Al-Qaeda. In the wake of 9/11, Iran was full of offers to the Bush administration, unwisely spurned, to help fight Al-Qaeda, help fight the Taliban. And Saudi, on the other hand, has an extremely equivocal relationship with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS. ISIS, in many ways, is an exterior manifestation of Saudi Wahhabi ideology. And so one of the points about the Houthis is that they are a much more respectable ally, much safer ally against Al-Qaeda than the Saudis. And it's worth bearing in mind that according to the BBC, the UAE, which is part of the Saudi-led alliance, is fighting with or on the same front as Al-Qaeda down in the south of Yemen.
Con, what
well,
would be
I would just, I would just like to correct a couple of things there. I mean, first of all, Iran gave a lot of Al-Qaeda people a safe haven when they fled Afghanistan after 9/11. And if you look at the formation of the new Al-Qaeda cells in Yemen, which pose a direct threat to the security of the UK, a lot of these were released from sort of house arrest, a very comfortable house arrest in Iran a year ago. And the Iranians have basically sent them off to Yemen to cause trouble. To say that the Saudi Arabians are equivocal with Al-Qaeda is a complete misunderstanding of the dynamic. It was only about 4 years ago that an Al-Qaeda bomber tried to blow up the interior minister in Riyadh with a device concealed in his anus. I mean, Al-Qaeda is at war with Saudi Arabia. Al-Qaeda is committed to the overthrow of the Saudi royal family. So to say that the Saudis are somehow in cahoots with Al-Qaeda to me seems complete nonsense. You know, we need the Saudis on side if we are to keep our streets safe, and the Iranians are never going to do us any favours on that front.
That was Peter Oborne and Con Cocklam. And finally, for country squires looking for year-round warmth and a readily available cooking surface, there has only ever been one choice, an Aga. But in this week's magazine, Mark Mason writes that the Aga Brigade have ruined this traditional kitchen fixture, turning it into a Mary Berry-infused status symbol rather than a practical object. The Spectator's Camilla Swift, however, is keen to defend Agas from this libel and champions them as the connoisseur's cooker. So who's right? Here to debate this hot topic, in more ways than one, are Mark Mason and Camilla Swift. So Mark, what have you got against Agas?
I haven't got anything for them. That's the simplest way of saying what's against them, is that there is nothing for them. They are cutting-edge technology of the 1930s. You know, when they came along, something that you could have on all the time as a cooking device made sense, because back then there was a woman in the kitchen, and it would have been a woman, cooking all day long.
Would
so
it?
She would. Back in those days it would. And she would never have turned it off, and so it made sense because it was in use the whole time. Then along came normal electric ovens and gas hobs, and they are perfect. There is nothing that an Aga can do that combination I've just said, an electric oven with a gas hob on top, is not better at.
And Camilla, you're a fan of the Aga. What do you make of Mark's
argument?
I
really do think there is. I think the thing is, if you think of an Aga as just an oven and a hob, then maybe you're not making the most of your Aga. I think an Aga is a bit like, I was sort of comparing it to a 4x4, in that if you use it for what it should be used for,
which is
it's
what?
Perfect. It's not, well, so if you live in a big, drafty country house, it does everything. You use it to heat the hot water, use it to heat the room, use it to cook everything, use it to dry everything. You dry your clothes over the Aga, you can heat your hot water, keeps the kitchen warm, which it would
dogs
not stay
like
warm
it.
Otherwise. The dogs love it.
Which I do live in, not a drafty country house, but I live in a country house, not a particularly big one, but the last few weeks, and we're recording this on the hottest September day, or the day after the hottest September day for X hundred years, And yesterday, I didn't have a kitchen, I had a sauna. And the point about heating your hot water, I've got a friend who lives near me who has got a oil-powered Arga that controls the heating. And if he or his partner have a bath in the afternoon, their dinner takes longer to cook. What a convenient device that is, eh?
Well, and I have to say, at Christmas, we have an Arga at home, and at Christmas time, you can't make a cup of tea on Christmas Day because the Arga will go down in
then
heat
it takes
and you can't
the
cook
heat.
Them out. So I mean, what's the point of it?
And just to quote the goddess Mary, your point there about dogs liking them and drying your clothes on them, the goddess Mary Berry, who I think is responsible for some of this,
in
the way that Joanna Trollope was several years before. And you'll notice, by the way, that the ovens on Bake Off aren't Argas. If they're so brilliant, why hasn't she got one using them on Bake Off on the few episodes she's got left?
Yes. I think you should do. I think they are really good for baking. I know you complain in your piece that there are lots of things an Arga can't do. But I have to say, what did you say? You said you can't do stir fry, which I've done plenty of stir fries.
You
said you can't grill. Sorry.
You can't grill, yeah.
I was reading other people said you can't stir fry, which is not true. I've done plenty of stir fries on an Arga. You said there's no grill, but if you put it in the top shelf of your top oven, you can grill perfectly.
No, I tried that the other night, actually.
Okay.
As I was writing the piece, just as a final check about the no grill thing, I thought, market research, I'm not going to put anything in an organ of note like The Spectator without checking it. And there was, I was doing a creme brulee with a sugar on top. I used to love doing that under my proper grill in our old house. By the way, we're getting rid of the Arga. We're going to buy this combination that I just said. Because despite my piece, I wrote this piece knowing that it doesn't matter if I slag them off. People are so illogical about them that there will still be a market for them. I'm still going to be able to sell mine. The creme brulee thing, I looked it up in the Mary Berry Arga cookbook.
Yeah.
What you're supposed to do, I tried putting the sugar on and putting it at the top of the oven that's supposed to replace the grill, and it didn't work at all. Her solution is that you have to cut out from a piece of greaseproof paper a circle of a size slightly smaller than the creme brulee you have made, sprinkle that with sugar, put it in, take it out, take the piece of sugar off the ovenproof paper, and then
it's
put
very
it on.
Clever.
No, it's very cumbersome.
Like a really good idea.
It's very cumbersome and ridiculously inappropriate for the 21st century.
You
want to go back in time. I bet you like Downton, don't you?
Not really.
You want to go back and
What's
live in Downton.
What's wrong with wanting to go back in time, Mark?
But I just think you're not making the most of your Arga. I think that's the problem.
No, I am.
You're not using. Well, you're not because you're not using it to heat water. Not using it. You do use it to dry anything on it.
Yeah, but that's ridiculous. You might as well just have a radiator, an electric radiator.
But then
radiator
you use
in
a radiator.
The...
Like we don't need a kettle. You don't need a toaster. You don't need a boiler. You don't need a tumble dryer. I don't have a tumble dryer.
I happen to know.
Don't
yeah, the kettle point.
Toaster.
I'm going to let Lara.
Don't have an electric kettle.
I'm going to let Lara answer the kettle point.
Well, we don't. I mean, we don't have an electric kettle at home. And most of the time it's fine. So I'm broadly pro-Arga, apart from there are times when you can't make tea.
Maybe one day a year when you have a problem making tea.
You know what?
So you could have an electric kettle to use on Christmas Day. And apart from that, you would have no problems whatsoever.
The ultimate proof that Argas are useless is that virtually everyone I know who's got one and raves about them also has. They say, "Oh, of course, you have to have a normal cooker as well, just for those times when you
don't." We don't have a normal cooker. Don't have any other cooker. We have one Arga. Don't have any kettle, any toaster. Never had any problems whatsoever.
Well, you're the exception that proves the rule. All these other people that have a normal cooker, they're basically saying,
"I don't know." You can just say all these people, Mark, because you say everyone in the country. Well, you're not. I know plenty of other people who do exactly the same as us. Only have an Arga. Don't have another oven. So maybe people in Norfolk, Suffolk, don't have another cooker as well as their Arga. People I know don't.
If I'm allowed to speak, Mr. Paxman, the people that I know that I've spoken to about it, these people with another cooker, they all, in my experience, your experience is different.
Yes,
okay. In my experience, they all say we need a proper cooker as well. They might as well be saying, oh, we love our car with no wheels. Obviously, we can't drive anywhere in it, and we have to have a real car with real wheels on it for when we do need to drive somewhere. But our car with no wheels has got such character.
Plenty of people have a 4x4, and then they have a small car when they're not driving up a mountain.
Well, obviously, talking about 4x4s, Range Rover is obviously a British brand. Argas are also a great British brand. Isn't there something that we should be proud of rather than...
That's what I mean,
off?
Yeah. It's wanting to go back to when Britain had an empire that covered most of the globe.
It's not
and
encouraging
it was,
British
it
business.
Is, no, it's going back in time. It's wanting to go back in time.
Why?
And because you're going back to when the Arga was cutting-edge technology.
You're not, because it does work perfectly.
Well, so you can now get Argas which are electric and you can turn them
mine's
off.
Electric,
so turn them on and
so
off.
So what's the problem then if you can switch it off? And...
Well, you can't. No, with the electric one, you have to have it on the
but
whole
there
time.
Are ones,
to
but there are
the
ones
time.
Which you can now turn on and off.
Well, then you might as well just have a normal cooker.
But if you want
where
to,
you can control it exactly. The other thing about
an Arga
is it's set
that does all the other things that you can do with an Arga that you can turn on and off.
Like what? So the dog likes lying by it, so therefore you should spend 8 grand
on this
thing.
Who boils a kettle on their oven? Who makes toast on their oven?
The toasting.
That you can do with your arga that you don't.
Look,
do
Camilla,
with
when I moved into the house, I was
explaining, and then you say what other things.
Camilla, when we moved into the house, I was really keen on trying this thing out. I like change. I've got to a stage in my life now where I think change is a good thing.
Yeah.
And so I did go and try it out. And the toasting, you're absolutely right. People were telling me about this wonderful arga toast. I went and tried it. It was useless.
Well,
it's quite flat, arga taste.
No, it's perfect. You put it's burnt on the outside, nice, not burnt, like nicely carbonated, and then all fluffy on the inside. I genuinely do think you might have a problem with your arga. If you can't boil water on it and you can't make toast on it, I genuinely think there's something wrong with your arga.
I've heard that often the arga men are quite sexy, so perhaps you could invite one of them.
Well, that's not going to persuade me. I mean, my partner might be interested
maybe
in
tell,
that, Laura.
Tell your partner about the sexy arga man who can fix your arga. And allow it to make proper toast.
No, my partner, it's interesting you mention her. She, for a long time, was sticking by the arga, going, no, this. And she's come around to my way of thinking now. She knows that it's inconvenient. Also the waste of it. You know, I sometimes get home at midnight, at 1 o'clock, and I see that thing. It's still on there, burning electricity, making our kitchen hot when it doesn't need to be. It is ridiculously wasteful.
Have you turned down temperature in the summer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's even more useless for all the things I've been talking about.
Maybe Camilla should come round to have a look at your arga.
Well, she sounds like it, with her fantastic sense of logic. And
but I genuinely do think they're perfect for the right situation. It is a bit like
the 1930s.
Defender. No, these days, just not everyone who lives in a little warm house that has a boiling kitchen.
Well, why can't you just have a normal
have a drafty kitchen? I've never had, our kitchen has never been too hot.
Okay, if you want to use your cooker as a heater, I think that's massively wasteful. But if you want to do that, get an electric oven and just leave it on the whole time with the door.
Why is that more wasteful
than
having central heating in an oven?
Because then the heating is on all night. That's the point. The arga is on
constantly.
But
you use it to heat something where there is heat needed.
No, the arga is on the whole night. You don't have your heating on
the
whole night, do you?
Well, some people do.
When?
Central heating all
year round. Who needs their kitchen to be like a sauna at 4 o'clock in the morning?
It's not like a sauna. That's what I'm saying. Your kitchen might be like
I have got one.
Your kitchen is like a sauna. My kitchen has never been like a sauna, and it has an arga in it.
Well, you live in a nice drafty house, but
yes,
most
exactly.
modern houses. My house is 200 years old, and even that isn't drafty enough to justify an arga.
Yeah. Well, maybe your house is not the perfect situation for an arga, which is what I'm saying.
That was Mark Mason and Camilla Swift. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? Reward yourself this weekend and pick up a copy of the most provocative magazine in Britain. We have a trial offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.